Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Hey, welcome back to another amazing episode of the Employee Cycle Podcast, and I'm your host for today, Bruce Marable. Today, we're very excited to chat with Brandon Atkinson, former Chief People Officer at AppNexus, about the topic of the DNA hiring. Brandon, thanks for coming to the podcast.
Thanks, Bruce. Great to be here.
Woo! Hey, Brandon!
All right. Woo!
All right. So, today we're going to have, and we're going to cover a really interesting topic about the DNA hiring. But before we do that, can you give us a brief summary of your background and how you ended up becoming the Chief People Officer at AppNexus, since your background is very interesting because you didn't have any prior HR roles before?
Yeah, sounds good. The way I think about my career is my very first role out of undergrad was as a community organizer as part of the AmeriCorps VISTA National Service Program. So I was a community organizer in Anchorage, Alaska, and that was actually the best training I've ever received for what would become a career largely focused on working for tech startups. And the reason it was just hugely helpful from a training perspective is, if you just look at, well, what do community organizers actually do? Well, they go into communities and knock on doors and try to identify latent talent that will, you know, want to be a part of this community organization. So that's recruiting. And then they get all these community folks together and they help them identify, like, what are the key things we want to do and how are we going to do it? So that's like organizational alignment. That's setting a mission. That's setting goals for ourselves. Then what do community organizers do? Well, then they train and develop those folks from the community to activate upon those goals. And so that's manager development. That's employee development. That's, team building. And then they do it in such a way that the community organizer's goal is always to work themselves out of a job so the community is self-sustaining and they can leave. Well, that's the mindset that every great organizational leader has. They're always trying to develop sustainability such that they're not actually needed. So in short, like, the core skills you learn as a community organizer are really the same fundamental skills you need to be a great organizational leader. And those are the same skills that I've been using throughout my career. So, AppNexus was my fourth startup. And, you know, throughout each one of those, it was really the same thing. So I built, like, my first two startups, I was largely building sales and services organizations. Then I joined a startup called Opsware, built their operations group. Then I built their training group. Then I needed somebody to go out to Romania and build an engineering group. So did each one of those. And then joined AppNexus. And when I joined AppNexus, I started as their SVP of Global Services. And I was employee number 28 and had the, you know, great fun and honor of helping build up the Global Services group from one person when I started to about 180 when I left it 5 years later. We built up AppNexus from 28 people to just north of 1,000 when I left it. And as the head of Global Services, it was largely the same thing. How do we build a self-sustaining organization? So 5 years into that, we had done that, and I spent a lot of that time just thinking about, how do we hire extraordinarily well? How do we onboard extraordinarily well? How do we measure and drive engagement? How do we improve diversity and inclusion? And so, you know, our CEO just asked me at one point, you know, how I felt about taking all that great stuff we had done in Global Services and, you know, work to bring it company-wide as our Chief People Officer. So jumped at that opportunity, and about 2.5 years ago started to do that, and had a great time, really built out a great people team.
That's awesome. And because you went through all that amazing growth, I'm sure you know a thing or two about hiring.
Yeah, hiring is probably the thing I've thought the most about. And it fundamentally starts from the idea that if you hire well, everything else, regardless of internal and external circumstances, gets so much easier. And if you don't hire well, really nothing else matters. Like, it's going to be an uphill struggle if you're able to be successful at all as an organization. So from that core philosophy, have largely focused a ton on how to do that well. And that's really where the DNA hiring framework that you and I have talked about, you know, came to be, was that very iterative focus on how to do that well.
So the listeners can have some context about the type of environment you were in while you created and was implementing the DNA hiring. Can you give the listeners a brief overview about AppNexus and what AppNexus does?
Yeah. So AppNexus is an internet advertising technology platform. So at core, we're a technology platform that allows buyers and sellers of online media, so advertising, to buy and sell in real time, which is called programmatic advertising. And so if you just sort of assume you have, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of people buying and selling ads in real time every single day, well, that's billions and billions of ads being served in real time every single day. And we invented real-time bidding, which essentially means the moment you go to a website, some information's passed through our platform about you and the site. We have hundreds of bidders that are essentially bidding on the ability to send you an ad in real time. And our platform has about 500 milliseconds to do that billions and billions of times a day. So very, very challenging, complex enterprise technology, which requires, you know, very extremely talented workforce.
Wow, that sounds like some pretty serious stuff. And thanks for that explanation. But since the title of this podcast and the topic is the DNA hiring, let's get right into it.
Yeah.
What is the DNA hiring? And did you create this, or is this something that was more mainstream and you just decided to implement it while heading up hiring and HR at AppNexus?
Well, like all good ideas, it's built on ideas that I've learned from others. But where it came from was when I mentioned I was at Opsware and I moved to Romania to build our engineering office. Well, I wasn't an engineer, so my ability to identify who are going to be great engineers was somewhat limited. And I wasn't Romanian, so my ability to have sort of, you know, broader social context on you know, where people have worked or where they went to school in terms of the value they might be able to create for Opsware was somewhat limited. So the unique, so it taught me a couple things. One, it taught me, you know, to identify talent, you need to be super clear about what you're looking for and how you're going to go about finding it, because in this context, it was much harder than normal. But two, what it taught me was where I could provide unique value was, you know, not being an engineer and not knowing much about like what their resume actually, like how to interpret that from where their competencies are. I had to find another way to identify talent, and I hadn't formally structured it yet when I was there, but the whole idea was what I found was, maybe I couldn't identify if they're going to be a great engineer specifically, but I was starting to develop this framework of, you know, how do you identify the qualities of potential? How do you identify the qualities of somebody that, regardless of their background, are highly likely to be able to grow and make an impact in their current role? So the seeds of this, you know, DNA hiring, which is essentially, instead of looking at your resume and skills and, you know, where you went to school and, you know, what your job titles were, instead of looking at those extrinsic things, start to look at more intrinsic things. What are the core capabilities people have, irrespective of all those extrinsic things? So those are things like problem solving or ability to learn and grow or customer service genes or analytical horsepower. So those types of things. And then when I joined AppNexus, and this is where it really starts to get interesting, is, you know, I was hired to run our global services group. So those are all the customer-facing product experts. And I knew nothing about internet advertising technology or internet advertising generally when I started, because I came from a variety of other different technology industries. Opsware was a data center automation company. But yet I had to build the team of the customer-facing product experts that were going to help them be massively successful on our platform. Because we don't even make money at the time we sell a deal. We only make money if customers are successfully adopting and spending on our platform. So what I found was I initially took the same shortcut a lot of hiring managers take, which is let me look at the resume and look at folks who came from internet advertising technology, or ad tech as it's called. And by and large, like, we didn't like a lot of the folks we were looking at for us. Nice people, but not a great fit necessarily for us. And so, you know, we're struggling to hire, and that's why they hired me, was to like build an organization with highly talented people. And I was kind of stressed out, like, how do I make this happen? And eventually we just sort of lifted out and said, okay, so wait a minute. So the resume is not going to tell me if they're the right fit. Their background, where they went to school necessarily isn't going to tell me if they're the right fit. So how do we know? And so what we did was we started by saying, all right, let's just lift out and say, fast forward a year from now, how are people going to, if our team is really successful, how do we want to be known? Like, what's the essence of the type of team we're going to have? And so we came up essentially with this sentence that says something to the effect of, you know, we're a team of multi-skilled, passionate problem solvers that are driven to make our customers massively successful. And said, all right, well, that's, so there's things there. We're problem solvers, we're multi-skilled, we're passionate about our customers. Said, all right, so we're starting to get like the DNA of like what's going to make us great as a team. And I said, all right, well, how do we identify what types of people are going to help create that type of team? And we said, all right, well, essentially there's five buckets of stuff. Like, the first one is, you know, they're going to have potential for growth and impact, because we're not going to be able to find a lot of folks from ad tech per se that are going to be great for our team. So the potential for growth and impact was huge, just concept of potential. And then we said, all right, well, they've got to like love solving problems, because that's the core of what we do. And so like analytical horsepower was like the second big thing, which essentially is just the ability to take complexity, break it down into small parts, and then solve problems based on those smaller pieces. The third thing we said is, all right, well, we're in service. So like the passion to serve others was deeply important. The fourth thing was they have to believe in our values. They have to be embodying our values. So being able to align for values was the fourth DNA part. And then the fifth part was the only one that was role specific. So all of our roles are somewhere on a continuum of consulting and highly technical. You have to be both, but you're on this continuum. Some of the roles are more consultative. Some of them are more just technical. And so one of the roles, pick those five. So we picked those five DNA elements. And we had at any given time 10, 12 different roles. But all the roles were interviewed for those five, because that's the DNA that ended up making people successful in our company. And the most important one was potential. So everybody came in. We had this thing called a blitz, where every Friday people would come in to be interviewed for global services. And we tell them, you're not interviewing for a specific role yet, because we're interviewing for a type of person. We actually put in our job descriptions, no previous relevant work experience required. And so for the first three interviews, which was, you know, potential, analytical, and, customer service gene, they didn't know what they were being interviewed for. And so we'd bring everybody in, like five or six people in a day, just for those three. And then during the lunch break, we let them hang out and have lunch, and then we do a debrief on those five. And the ones that were extraordinary, we said, all right, you can go on to the afternoon. The ones that weren't a great fit, we very politely told them, you know, they can go home. Thanks for coming in, and thanks for their interest. And then the second half of the day, we dug in deeper to then identify what specific role they were going to, you know, be applying for. So we found was, and then I'll summarize it, is by interviewing for DNA, for all of the roles, you can have one streamlined interview loop for all the different roles. And by emphasizing potential as the most important DNA element, you're able to hire people that didn't have industry specific experience. And yet and so it might have taken them longer, 3 months, 6 months in to get successful. But 9 months, 12 months, 18 months in, they far surpassed a lot of folks who we could have hired who came in running because they knew advertising technology. So that's one benefit. They scaled farther, faster 12 months out. But the second benefit was, you know, probably the thing I'm most proud of now at AppNexus is folks we hired into the global services function, because we hired for potential to grow and make an impact, are now leaders in commercial, they're leaders in product, they're leaders in engineering. It became a feeder farm of talent for the rest of the organization. So that's the second benefit. And the third and last benefit is it helps you with diversity and inclusion in two ways. One, because you're broadening the aperture of what you consider to be talent, it opens up entirely new talent pools that you otherwise wouldn't look at. Because ad tech is largely driven, as a lot of technology spaces are, by a bunch of white guys, and then throw in some Asian males. And there's not a lot of diversity in the traditional tech pools other than that. So to broaden the aperture, you have to be able to broaden the aperture of what you view as talent. And interviewing for DNA and particularly potential allows that to happen. So it definitely helped with our diversity and inclusion initiatives.
Great. And that was a great way to segment into really talking about the framework. One of the things that we like to do here in the podcast is to really talk about the granular details of how to actually implement this in your own company for the listeners. So I'm going to reference one of your blog posts titled "The Alchemy of Org Building, Hiring for What Will Be Over What Is." And you mentioned that during the hiring process, previous professional and educational experience isn't the best indicator for future success, but that you should hire for capabilities, passions, and value. So I would like to break those three things down. So let's talk about the first one, which is capabilities. What are you looking for, and how are you hiring for capabilities? What does that look like for our listeners?
Yeah, so let me word it sort of the, if you're running one team, and then if you're running, again, for the whole company. So by capabilities, those are those five things four of those five things that I mentioned before. So, analytical horsepower is a capability. It's a problem-solving capability. Or customer service, is actually another capability. Or, I would argue in our context, values is actually a capability, because our values at AppNexus were things like see and improve the whole system, or, make greatness happen. So these are actually capabilities as value. So interviewing for those things. Now, that's easier if you're a team, because you've got like the discrete group and you can say, all right, what are the core capabilities needed for the group? But how do you do it if you're multiple groups or a whole company? Well, once I took the role of chief people officer, what we did was we went out and interviewed like all the teams in the company and said, all right, what are the things you're interviewing for? What are you looking for? And we started out with this list of 75 capabilities. And then we synthesized that down to about 15. And said, all right, like at core, because some of them there was overlap or they really weren't clear. We synthesized it down to 15 capabilities. And so that's extra things like, being able to have presentations and verbal communication. So for a sales or commercial roles, that's deeply important. Or if you're in engineering, understanding technical and architectures is like a broad core capability. So those are others. So we synthesized it down into 15, and then we rolled out the DNA hiring framework to the whole company and said, listen, the five or six that matter to you might vary by function or role. But these 15 are relevant, are potentially relevant for any. So pick five or six of them. And that's going to be how we identify talent, how we recruit for your open roles, for your team, and assign one person a capability for the interview loop, which means like if I'm Jane and I'm interviewing somebody, I'm always interviewing for the same capability for that role over and over and over again. So I'm always looking for the same things. I have the same set of questions. I have the same set of success criteria. And everybody in the interview loop has a different capability. So from a candidate experience perspective, they're not repeating themselves over and over and over again, because actually every interviewer is looking for a distinctly different capability. And so we're able to get the whole company then on this DNA hiring framework by working to identify what are the capabilities that we care about across the whole company. And then through training, we trained all of them, and potential is actually the most important because we're such an agile company, we're changing all the time, you need people that can scale with the company. And then the last thing I should add that we did was to help roll this out, we also, you need to lead with philosophy, like how you think about any of this stuff. And so we defined our core hiring philosophy and designed a training around it that we gave to all of our training managers. And at Nexus, our hiring philosophy was first and foremost, hire for potential. Also hire for potential, hire for diversity, hire for potential, diversity, and there were two others that are skipping right now. Potential, diversity, inspiration, and values. So those were the four. So we trained everybody in that because that's the high-level lens through which we all approached hiring.
Great. So next you said hiring for passion. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean hiring them to be passionate about the role that they're applying for? Hiring for them to be passionate about the company or the industry that they're going into? Or just being a passionate person in general about anything?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So this concept of passion, honestly, most people at AppNexus aren't passionate about advertising technology per se. Very few actually are. They were passionate about, for example, our mission of creating a better internet. They were passionate about solving customers. They were passionate about solving hard problems. So it's not necessarily passion for the functional thing that the company does, but it's passion generally. And so what you find is that people with passions tend to be all in on things. If you're passionate about something, you go all in on it. So it could be, and it ties, by the way, to this be inspired. Like you're inspired because you find people are passionate about something and they go all in on it. So it could be a work thing that they are passionate about, algorithmic data science, and they design this incredible algorithm. Or it could be out of work, they're a street magician and they're really passionate about doing that extraordinarily well. It could be they're a product specialist, but who also happens to be passionate about poetry and they write and they're all in it. So, passion is sort of a proxy for they go all in on things. But the other thing, it also helps you with inclusion, because when you're hiring for passions, people have all these different interests and then they join the company and they come at it from, they have all these different passions and perspectives. And so, you're not hiring one sort of misogynistic or, I'm sorry, sort of homogeneous workforce. You're hiring people that come from all these different backgrounds and all these different passions, which makes a really, really vibrant work experience.
Got it. And if passion sounds anything like the way that you're answering these questions, then you definitely can tell you're passionate about this topic. And lastly, hiring for values.
Yeah,
this seems to be the most difficult, and maybe it's just me, but what exactly does hiring for values mean? And again, is it making sure that the person who's interviewing has values, or is it that they fit the values set by the company? What does that look like?
Yeah, well, this particular one, it's for something and against something. Let me start with what it's against. And what it's against is this concept of hiring for culture. What it's against is this concept of culture fit. The fundamental problem with culture fit as a hiring philosophy, or as even something you allow yourself to think about as a hiring approach, is it accelerates and amplifies an existing problem in hiring, which fundamentally is that people tend to want to hire mini-me's. They tend to want to hire people that they feel an affinity with, that they feel that, the airport test, would I feel comfortable talking to them at an airport bar, or would I want to take this person out for a drink? All that stuff actually is not helpful and is actually hurtful from a hiring perspective, because you end up hiring people with your same qualities. And when you hire people with your same qualities, what happens is, to one degree, your best qualities get amplified because they're building on each other. But what happens is your worst qualities also get amplified. Meaning, so for example, one of the many problems of having a workforce of largely, that a lot of tech companies face, of being largely a young white male workforce, is, those folks tend to come from similar backgrounds that get involved in tech, and their best and worst qualities get amplified when you put them all together. It's just what happens when you put people who are similar together. They feed off each other in good and bad ways. And so what we're saying is, hiring for culture fit is absolute BS. You can hire for culture add, which means they bring something new and different, which to me is actually what the hiring for inspiration is all about. But we're saying don't hire for culture, hire for values, which means as a company, you have to have your values defined. And so that nexus, I mentioned a couple of them. We were, you know, make greatness happen. So we had like learn and teach. Learn and teach was our core sort of cornerstone value. And so you can interview for these things. So if I'm interviewing for learn and teach, you'll just ask questions like, hey, give me an example where you didn't have to learn something, but you taught yourself just because you wanted to. Or you can ask, give me an example where you didn't have to teach somebody something, but you were so excited about something, and this person showed interest in it, so you went out of your way to teach them that thing. So, or another value that we have is make greatness happen. So we said, look, give us an example where a time where you were like really under a lot of adversity, and so what you had to do was something really hard, but you pushed through and you had like amazing outcomes through that adversity. So like you can interview those things. So again, what it's against is this concept of hiring for culture fit, which is BS. And what it's for is define your values as a company and hire them, because that gets weaved into the fabric of who you are. And as you scale from 5 to 50 to 500 to 5,000, if you keep hiring for values throughout that, the culture that you have, which is essentially the amplification manifestation of your values, will largely stay true through that growth.
Hey, podcast listeners. We're about halfway through this episode, so now it's time for a word from our sponsor. But don't worry, we'll be back.
Are you trying to make your HR department more data-driven, but there's not enough time in the day? Are you tired of managing all your HR data in messy spreadsheets? Then you need EmployeeCycle, the real-time HR dashboard helping small and medium-sized companies use HR data to achieve workforce goals. EmployeeCycle pulls all your HR data from your HR systems and creates a beautiful web-based dashboard, making it easier to identify problem areas and track trends. You can even give your CEO and leadership team access so they can stay updated on workforce insights all the time. Learn more at EmployeeCycle.com and sign up for your free demo today. Now back to this amazing episode.
So I'm sure there are many listeners out there saying, okay, Brian, I get it. You struck a chord with me. I think I want to implement the DNA hiring process. You know, I'm buying what you're selling. Where do I start? And more importantly, how do I get buy-in from either my HR team, my leadership team, or just the company overall, in regards to revamping our current recruiting process to really change it and look more like the DNA hiring process?
Yep. Yeah, different in terms of getting buy-in, because you have to start with buy-in to get any forward momentum. Different constituents will care about different things. So, for example, your C-level staff and your CEO will probably pretty quickly get and understand the need to hire for values, and or the need to hire for diversity and inclusion. And if nothing else, they will certainly get the need to be able to have a really high bar as you hire throughout time. So like find out like what's the thing that they're going to be excited about, because it's just a stand, like to achieve any of those things, you have to be able to have a consistent hiring framework to get you there. So get people to agree, like, what's important to them? And almost irrespective of what's important to them, you could say, all right, you could see certainly how to be able to identify, you know, talent that will help us achieve that, we need to have a consistent hiring framework. And they'll say, yep, we need a consistent hiring framework. And then there's one level down, which is sort of your senior manager types. They tend to be harder because they tend to think, oh, I already have a great way to hire. Like, I know how to do this. You don't have to tell me how to hire. Like, I've been hiring my whole career. So the way to get them is to say, okay, but we can make hiring easier and faster for you by identifying these core capabilities. And that way, so when you're kicking off a new search, you don't have to start from scratch and say, okay, well, we're going to have these five people interview, and so gosh, what should I ask Jane to interview for? And what should I ask Bobby to interview for? Like, how do I do this really efficiently? So what they care more about is like, okay, capabilities, fine, but you're actually going to give me a library to choose from, and you're going to give me the questions to ask. And so that way, once I build my interview team, it's like super easy for me because like you've already got the questions. And so you just give Jane her set and Bobby his set and Bill his set, and like, boom, I'm off like to the races to interview really, really quickly. So they tend to actually get on board more from that lens. And then your recruiting team is going to be excited because, A, they're excited. It'll make their life easier because there's a structure and a framework to latch on to. And they more generally get, like, this is just a standard best practice that everybody should follow because it's in terms of, like, this concept of hiring consistently. But what they might push back, and sometimes I do get pushed back on this concept of hiring for potential across the board. And the reason is because people tend to do interviews in a way that is actually sort of this form of like psychological aggrandizement, meaning they're interviewing people to make them feel good about themselves. Because they say, hey, I'm interviewing Jane and she's got these qualities and I have those qualities, so I like Jane because I like me. And it's not conscious, it's subconscious. And it's one of the reasons why most interviews fail. It's because it's actually this form of like making yourself feel good about yourself by identifying people that have your qualities and saying, hey, I like that. And so it's hard actually to get people to break out and say, well, you know, and like, so you have to kind of show them research on unconscious bias and say, look, this is real. Like it's data science driven. Unconscious bias is a real thing. And so, You have to, and so some people you have to break out of it and say, okay, so like, I have to stop looking for mini-me's because it's actually my unconscious bias kicking in. And then if you can get people again through research to see that, you know, hiring for potential allows people to grow and scale faster, they can tend to get bought in as well, particularly when they actually look at, well, like, how do you do that? And so providing training specifically in how to hire for potential helps get those people on board who don't really understand it or might be a little bit skeptical to get in. So you definitely have to have training around it.
So if I'm the HR person bringing this to the table, how fully baked of a foundation or framework do I already have to have before I present this to the leadership team or the stakeholders? Am I including the leadership team? Am I including the stakeholders in creating this process so that this is more of a collaborative process? Or am I really taking the bull by the horns and saying, you know what, I believe this is what we should do for our organization, and then getting feedback after that?
You definitely want conceptual buy-in before you start. Generally with all things people, and I love the function, but one of the hard things is like a lot of people think they already know everything there is to know about people. So, you know, if you just sort of like come in and say, we're going to do this, they're going to say, well, I've been doing this other thing for 10, 20, 30 years of my career. Like, who are you to tell me we're now going to do that? So getting conceptual alignment on why having, sort of capability based interviews is helpful, and having a consistent interview framework is helpful, is really the first step. And again, there's a ton of research to prove why this is the way to go. So if you come at it from a look, this is what the science says, that certainly helps. But the second key attribute, and so once you have conceptual alignment, is piloting. What a lot of HR organizations, when they fail, is when they do sort of big bang to say, all right, we've designed this master thing, and now we're going to roll it out to the whole company at once. You tend to get a bunch of pushback on that. And so it's easiest from a people perspective. You're like, hey, we're like super efficient. We're going to do it all at once. But it's you need to build iterative learning and gradual rollout into everything you do, including this. So piloting is super helpful. So starting off with who's the organization that it has the most maturing the most mature approach to hiring, as the most thoughtful hiring manager. Start with them because they'll get it really, really quickly. And so pilot it there because other organizations tend to know through tribal knowledge, oh, wow, those folks hire really well. So if they're on board, then I can think about being on board. And then roll it out gradually, org to org to org, over the course of, you know, depending on the size of your org, anywhere from one quarter to a year. It took us a year, and a 1,000-person company, to get this fully rolled out in a piloted way. So that way it's not, oh, what's this big thing Brandon's throwing at me? Or what's this big thing the people org is throwing at me? It's, oh, here's another tool to make my life easier as a hiring manager. And it happens gradually. You tend to get much easier adoption that way.
That was great. And you actually almost answered my next question. But I also wanted the listeners out there, specifically those in HR who are in departments that may be under-resourced, or they already don't have enough HR professionals to even handle all the things they want to do today. How long should they expect to put this process together, whether it's the rollout part or even just coming up with the framework?
Yeah. I think the first thing it really gets down to, if you're an HR leader, where you make investments in your own time and which staff you hire. And when we were at AppNexus, we had, you know, like a 42-person people team, and half of them were in recruiting. And it is worth it. It is worth it. Like, again, there are companies that have much, much larger than that. But for a company of 1,000 people, that's more sizable than a lot of other companies. And so as an HR leader, just starting from the premise of, if I do this right, this is the most important thing I do. As an HR leader, as a functional leader, as a CEO, the most important thing you do is ensure you have the right people in the company. So make sure you make outsized investments in it from a staffing and, you know, resourcing perspective. So then that then says, all right, well, how long does it take? Again, it varies a lot by the size of the team and of the org. But generally anywhere from a quarter to year, year and a half, depending on how big it is, because it's better to do it gradually in a phased rollout than big bang, because you'll have more ease of adoption and it's more digestible for your team.
What did you learn from going through this process? And for anyone who was looking to implement the DNA hiring process, what can you tell them about some of the pitfalls or mistakes that you made during the process?
I think you'll learn as you go always. And so, for example, and this is why I was talking about piloting. So when you're piloting, what are the things you're iterating on? Like, what are you learning as you go? So first you define capabilities, and then you have to define what are the questions we have to ask to determine if those people have those capabilities. And then you have to define what successful answers look like. And so then you end up creating this rubric of those components: capability, questions, and, you know, what you're looking for in the answers. And as you then test that rubric in the field, you start to realize, like, oh, those questions aren't really getting at what I want, or, oh, what I thought were the right answers aren't really coming. Like, there's different types of right answers, because that rubric is the fundamental tool that you're giving all of your hiring managers to use as a framework to identify talent. So you're iterating a lot on that rubric to make sure that you're defining the capabilities, questions, and responses, best practice responses, in the best possible way. So that's one thing. The second thing you're probably iterating on is, you know, all of this requires manager training and interview training. So you should be thinking about, how do I continually improve these things over the course of the year? That, like, every time you're giving that training, you're iterating on it, making it better, making it better, making it better. And so everything, you should just think of all of these things as an iterative process where, like, I think a lot of the core mistake people teams make is, like, they roll things out and they think, okay, boom, like, it's done. Like, hey, we told everybody about it, go do it. And it doesn't work that way. A, your first answer is rarely the best answer. And B, like, rolling out a new process or framework isn't the hard part. User adoption is the hard part. And so continuing to figure out, all right, well, how do I sell this into the engineering org? It's going to be different than how you sell it into the commercial org, which is going to be different than how you sell it into the finance org, because they each have their own cultures and different things resonate with them than other functions. So you're also iterating on that. Like, how do I speak about this to hiring managers in different functions, because they're motivated in different ways?
So you already alluded to this a little bit already, but we all know that there's a lot of focus around unconscious bias in the hiring process, especially around showing bias towards women and people of color. Were there any specific things in the DNA hiring process that helped with this process to overcome some of those biases?
Yeah, I think the big one is, as part of your standardizing the framework for hiring, we instilled a deliberation process where each of the interviewers are required to get together and talk it through. And then we train the recruiter who's facilitating those deliberation sessions for indications of unconscious bias seeping in. And then it's the recruiter's job to call it out when they see it. So examples of that are, we know in interviews, research shows that men are much more comfortable talking about their accomplishments in a very strong, vocal, direct way than women are. And so, again, on average. And so when, and so sometimes the recruit, and so like, you know, if you have somebody saying, oh, I interviewed this guy and he had all these accomplishments and I just didn't see those in the female candidate, the recruiter is then trained to like dig deeper and say, well, did you ask, or did anybody else see an accomplishment in this particular area or capability and, you know, indications of it in this particular area that somebody else didn't see? Or if the recruiter knows that the hiring manager is of a certain personality type, maybe they're an extrovert, and the recruiter can see, okay, well, one candidate was an extrovert, the other was an introvert, and the extrovert is liking the extrovert. Like, are they creating space for people to fully deliberate the introvert? And so they're trained to like identify like what are these signs of unconscious bias, and are we really showing them? Or like another example is research shows that men and women tend to believe, okay, if it's a stretch role for a male candidate, be an internal candidate or an external candidate, like it's a stretch role, like they haven't done it yet, they tend to give men the benefit of the doubt that like, oh, okay, you're close enough, you'll stretch into that role. Whereas with the female candidate, again, be an internal and external candidate you're considering, they tend to say, no, like they don't have those skills yet. So research shows that you tend to give men the benefit of the doubt more than women. So you train the recruiters and what are all the signs of unconscious bias, so they can try to identify and call it out throughout the process.
Got it. Well, I mean, with so much of that going on, especially in the tech space, hopefully a lot more people will implement the DNA hiring framework to hopefully overcome this in the space. So after you implemented this, after the year, what were the results and some of the positive and potentially negative things that you saw afterwards that happened?
Let's talk about the negative. I can't emphasize enough how important effective manager training is. Because everybody thinks, and the reason it's so important is because most people think they interview well. Even people that have very limited interview experience, like, they tend to think they interview well. And so, and what happens is, like, when you think you interview well is when you actually start to interview poorly, both because unconscious bias sets in, as well as you tend to get sloppy and not be as focused on, like I have a role to play, like you're on a sports team and everybody has a role to play. When you're doing an interview, you have a role to play. And so don't allow yourself to go sprawling, interviewing, like, wherever the conversation will take you. Like, focus on your role, on which is interviewing for your particular capability. So where it goes bad is if you don't, is like it atrophies. Like, people tend to start to get sloppy. They tend to revert back to what's comfortable, which is, I'm just going to have a general conversation and I'm going to forget my unconscious bias. And so continually reminding folks, you're not a good, like, be humble about interviewing. I've interviewed, because I've been in startups my whole career. Yeah, I've literally interviewed thousands of people. I've hired hundreds and hundreds of people. And I still believe, like, I'm not a good interviewer. And I force myself to have that general approach. I call it, and this is part of the training, I call it the I don't trust myself technique. And so I intentionally go into every single interview, and this is part of the manager training, saying, look, I do a check 2 minutes in. Because you know a lot of people say, oh, I know in 2 minutes if I like this person or not. So 2 minutes in, I ask myself, do I want to hire this person or not? And if the answer is yes, then I spend the next 58 minutes in the interview trying to convince, or maybe 50 of the 58, trying to convince myself, I actually don't want to hire this person. There's something about them that's not going to be a good fit. So I try to change my lens to the opposite of how I know I'm feeling. And the reason that's important is because, again, I'm trying to counter the unconscious bias I know I have. And two, what happens is, again, it's unconsciously, but in all interviews, we tend to ask questions to confirm what we already believe. So you need to check in 2 minutes. What do I already believe? And then you need to start asking questions that counter what you already believe, because your natural tendency is to ask questions that confirm what you already believe. And so this is just an example of, well, what goes wrong? You spend all of this time on training and methodology, and then it's too easy to get too comfortable and too confident that you're actually great at interviewing when you're not. And so actually reminding folks over and over and over again, like, you're not. None of us are. This is really, really hard. Is probably one of the most important things to keep things on the right track long term.
And one of the things that I've been reading a lot about in regards to overcoming unconscious bias during the hiring process is standardizing and streamlining the questions. Is what I've seen, yep. Or at least what the research has said, is that when you go on who you're, yep, interviewing, you may go off script and start asking different questions because that person is more like you. Whereas if the person is different from you, so let's just say white male interviewing black female, all of a sudden, yep, the posture changes, it becomes more of a harsh, yep, interview, and the questions change to make it a little bit more difficult. Did the DNA hiring process help get rid of that and streamline the scripts as well?
Oh, 100%. Because A, you're being specific on what's the capability you as an interviewer are looking for. It could be one or two. And then you're giving them the three or four questions per capability. I mean, you give them like six or seven, I guess, but to ask, to identify if they have the capability, like the script's all there. And so again, like, you can actually control, like, well, what happens once you're in the live and people start asking questions, but like, you're setting them up for success by giving them the framework in advance. And then one of the things we do as a best practice for new interviewers, the first time they're interviewing, or sometimes it's the first two or three times, we have one of our recruiters shadow them in the interview specifically for the purpose of giving them feedback on how they did as an interviewer. Because that's the whole problem with all this stuff. Like, you do all this framework, you do all this training, you put them in the interview, and they just go do their own thing because it's comfortable, because they're still learning the approach. And so having a recruiter sit in the interview itself the first time or two to then give them coaching afterwards on how they did against the interviewing best practices is a good way to really embed what you're trying to achieve into the both the culture as well as the skill development of the interviewer.
And then last question about the DNA hiring process. For all the listeners out there, what are some of the things that you can tell them, if they don't remember anything else, that they should be doing when implementing this process?
Yeah, I mean, the top three things, like, thing number one is get buy-in that a consistent framework and investing the time to design and train people in the consistent framework is research proven the best path to have consistently outstanding results, to have diverse, extraordinarily talented people hired. So that's one. Like, get people involved. Like, it's, you just have to show the science. Step number two is, in order to identify what those capabilities are, have an inclusive process where you're talking to hiring managers about what they look for, and then do the work to synthesize it down for them into this bite-sized chunk of libraries that you can then create this rubric from. And again, the rubric has components of capability, questions, what you're looking for, and the answers. So inclusive process to then identify your rubric. And then step three is, remember, rolling out a new framework or process is not the hard part. Getting adoption, sustainable adoption over a long period of time is the hard part. So know that two-thirds of your effort in rolling out any initiative needs to be training and long-term adoption. One-third of the effort is the design and deliverables for the thing itself. So just have that mental framework of like two-thirds. It's like, okay, I think I'm done because like all this design and deliverable work is done. That's only a third of it. Like two-thirds of it is actually ongoing training and reinforcement of what it is you're trying to achieve.
Great. And I hope all the listeners were taking notes because you really gave them a lot to think about and a straightforward framework for them to follow. So now we're going to go into a section which I like to call the real, the random, and the ridiculous, where I ask you a real question, a random question, and a ridiculous one. So the real question. Everyone who has listened before knows that I am a bread pudding connoisseur. I am a bread pudding enthusiast. So I would like to know, Brandon, do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made? this is a very real question.
You know, I actually do like bread pudding, but I know pretty much nothing about it other than when I see bread pudding on the menu, I'm inclined to pick it.
Okay. Well, then, hey, that means that we can go out to dinner.
All right.
If you get it, if you order it, then there we go. I'm happy about that.
All right.
So, the random question. What is your favorite word and why?
My favorite word is the question why, is the word why. My favorite word.
Huh.
And the reason is because, you know, I'm a history major by training, and I studied psychosocial history, which is like using psychological principles to understand historical transformation. And so I just love to understand why things are the way they are, why people do things the way they do, why we end up being, you know, the types of people that we are, and why we pick the career paths we are, and why systems become what they are. Like, I just love understanding the why behind all things.
That's a pretty great answer. I appreciate that. So, the ridiculous question.
Yeah.
You can answer this one of two ways. One, either what is the most ridiculous hiring practice you've seen?
Oh, yeah.
Or what is the most ridiculous interview question that you've ever seen being asked?
Yeah, I'll talk about hiring practice. We at UpNexus, we acquired a company a while back, and I visited there. They were not in the headquarters; they were in a remote office. And I visited to give, basically, I have a training on this topic, and so I was giving the training, and then one of the VPs in the office said, "So, Brandon, are you telling me that we've been doing it wrong the whole time?" I'm like, well, I don't know how you do it. Let's talk about that. How do you do it? And they said, well, we have the candidate come in, and we have, you know, like, we're a very democratic, inclusive culture, so we want everybody to feel like they participate. So we have five or six people interviewing the candidate at the same time.
Oh, wow.
AKA Shark Tank interviewing.
Definitely putting that in the podcast.
Yeah.
We might have to trademark that.
Oh, man. And so, I mean, just imagine yourself, like, there's five or six people interviewing you at the same time, and this is an engineering office. And what's even harder about that is, you know, as, like, we have the same challenges a lot of engineering functions have, which is largely a bunch of white men. So just sort of assume, like, what's the probability of you being able to hire non-white men when you've got this candidate, let's say it's a female coming in to be interviewed, and she's being grilled by six white men at the same time? Probability of that candidate wanting to join your office is very, very low.
I would imagine so.
Yeah, so Shark Tank interviewing is definitely not the way to go.
Man, I think that was one of the best answers that I've heard so far.
All right.
All right, and then last question of the interview. What is your favorite and least favorite part of HR?
My favorite part of HR is having a upfront view of watching people scale and develop as a professional and develop as a person in their careers, and being able to see that at scale is just my number one with a bullet favorite thing in the world. My least favorite thing is, you know, the hard thing about HR is it's an influencer role, and you certainly could come down and roll out a lot of process and say, here are the mandates, but that never really works. You can't really get true adoption. And so you just have to spend a tremendous amount of time and energy getting people on board. And it's the right thing to do. And I tend to be an inclusive decision maker by, you know, I'm just kind of wired that way. But it can just take a lot longer than I'd like to get stuff done at times.
Well, Brandon, you've been an awesome guest. And this has been an amazing podcast interview.
Thank you so much for coming. Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate you. So, where can the people who are listening find you online?
Yeah, great question. Twitter handle is Atkinson000. You can find me there. And pretty soon I'm going to be launching my own blog site called thealchemyofworkbuilding.com. So just Google search or Bing for Alchemy of Org Building, and you'll find me there. Or, of course, on LinkedIn, Brandon Atkinson.
That's great. And we'll definitely be putting Brandon's contact information and all his internet places where you can find him in the show notes. Thank you for listening, folks. This is great. Also, just want to tell you again that if you're working on using data to improve your diversity, engagement, compensation, or anything else, definitely go to employeepsycho.com to sign up for the demo of the HR dashboard that can help you do that. And also, we would love if you can give us a 5-star rating on iTunes if you love this episode, and also subscribe to our podcast feed in your favorite podcast player. Well, folks, we did it again. Stay tuned for the next episode. And for the HR pros out there, keep hiring, training, and retaining the best workforce possible. Later, kids.